Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Isabel Hardman and James Forsyth. So tomorrow, MPs return to Parliament and business finally gets underway after a long summer. Theresa May is still in power. As far as we know, she is still a number 10. Isabel, how secure is her position looking?
Well, surprisingly secure, particularly given her surprising announcement last week that she wants to carry on and on. I was expecting, I have to say, a huge amount of resentment within the party. And obviously there are people who are annoyed that she's being so presumptuous when it's only a few months since she completely failed at the snap election. But actually, key backbenchers are being very supportive. And what's been really interesting about the summer is the way that the 1922 Committee of Conservative MPs have really rode behind Theresa May and shored up her position and have really called on ministers to behave themselves as well, to the extent that the 1922 Committee have been pushing actually for Theresa May to carry out a reshuffle, which is being heavily hinted about again in today's papers.
James, do you think Theresa May will carry out a reshuffle? Is it still quite a risky strategy if it looks like she's doing it to punish MPs or ministers?
I think she will, because I was talking to one of her closest confidants a few days ago, and they were saying that 2 months ago, ministers were treating her very badly because they didn't think she had any power over them. And, you know, and I think within the semi-privacy of a cabinet room, I mean, there was quite a lot of humiliating of her. You know, people basically took the opportunity to say all the things that they weren't allowed to say to her before the election when she was in the ascendant. And I think they would like to kind of get ministers back in line with this threat of a reshuffle. But obviously, when you're a prime minister, as David Cameron used to say, you're at your most powerful when people are expecting a reshuffle in the next 2 to 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And I think they would like people to be expecting a reshuffle in the next 2 to 3 weeks for as long as possible. So I think what we will do, I mean, the choreography will be, we hear the reshuffle's coming after conference, which is designed to get both ministers to behave at conference and ambitious backbenchers. Then we'll hear that the reshuffle is coming in the new year. Because once you actually carry out the reshuffle, you lose some power, mm-hmm, because you've sacked people who might well respond by writing a letter to the chairman of 1922 expressing no confidence in you. And you've also not promoted people. And remember, MPs have the ability to delude themselves when it comes to promotion. There will be lots of people who we would all laugh at the idea of them being fast-tracked into the cabinet or bumped up from the junior ministerial ranks. But they will be at home thinking, maybe this time.
Number 10 is being very bullish about the prospects of a reshuffle privately. If you talk to people who work there, that they are sort of highlighting the fact that backbenchers are very supportive of this. I think another factor in James's prediction that the reshuffle might get delayed a little bit to keep people on their toes is that lots of ministers, lots of backbenchers are putting pressure now on Philip Hammond to come up with a good budget, and they're saying that that's actually more of a key event this autumn than the party's conference, because Philip Hammond's last economic statement didn't actually go particularly well, the unravelling of the national insurance contributions for the self-employed was actually one of the ingredients in the pre-election briefing about moving Hammond. So if Hammond has a second bad budget, then you can have a reshuffle that doesn't look like a revenge reshuffle for summer bad behaviour, but actually a reshuffle based on merit. Now, I suspect that she still wouldn't be able to move Philip Hammond, but
I mean, if there is a reshuffle, people have said that it could be a chance to promote fresh talent in a way leading it up to a point when Theresa May goes, whether it is the full five or two, that these people have ministerial experience. In the Times today, Jacob Rees-Mogg is one of those who had tipped. James, do you think that's a likely scenario that we'd see Rees-Mogg getting a junior ministerial role?
I mean, Jacob Rees-Mogg as a junior minister is very likely. He is clearly a highly intelligent person. I think he'd be a very competent minister. You can imagine him as a potentially, I mean, look, he's obviously on the harder Brexit wing of the party, but he's also a kind of cross the detail. He's not Peter Bone. He's not some, you know, he might present this persona, but there's a very sharp mind there. You know, I mean, Spectator Life ran a piece about how much money he made in the city, and you don't do that if you're a fool. I think that Jacob Rees-Mogg probably isn't likely in line to be offered a job. I mean, the other interesting question is, you know, does someone like Tom Tugendhat, who's become chairman of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, would he rather be a junior minister or sitting in that perch? That'll be an interesting question to see what happens there. And I also think that however much a growing number of Tories, particularly Tory grandees and particularly grassroots Tories, would like us to do the kind of full Michael Howard and basically turn around and start saying, right, here are the five or six people who are likely to run for the leadership in 2019/2020. I'm going to give them all big jobs so we can see who has got what it takes, if any of them do. I don't think she'll do that. because I think the Whip's office remain convinced they don't want to totally extinguish hope on behalf of members of the 2010 intake, which is still this very large kind of bulbous intake. And I think they want to keep those people's hopes of making cabinet one day alive. And as soon as people from an intake below that start progressing up the ladder, it becomes clear that your moment has passed if you're in that intake.
Now, this Thursday, we have the EU withdrawal bill coming to Parliament. There's been a lot of bluster in the papers, particularly over the weekend, about potential rebellions. As well, how much trouble is brewing?
I don't think second reading is where the drama is going to be. Certainly, most of the Tory Remainers or Brexit sceptics or whatever you want to call them are planning to table amendments at committee stage. You can't actually table detailed amendments at report at second reading stage anyway. You tabled something called a reasoned amendment, which is a way of rejecting the bill and giving an explanation for that. So they want to focus on the details so they appear less troublesome and more like scrutineers, basically. And Labour hasn't yet decided what its position is formally. It's got shadow cabinet meeting tomorrow where it will decide not just whether it's going to vote against second reading, but also what it's going to do on the programme motion. And the programme motion is the timetable for the bill as it progresses through the rest of its stages in the Commons. And that's where there might be some trouble, particularly actually, I think, if Labour Remainers think that their whips are conceding too much to the Tory whips as they negotiate over the programme motion behind the scenes.
James, obviously this question we have every podcast, so we need to ask it. What is Labour's current Brexit position?
Well, I think it is moving. I mean, it moved again on Sunday when Tom Watson seemed to suggest that Labour were moving towards being the party of soft Brexit, you know, stay in the single market and the customs union forever. Keir Starmer kind of tried to row that back a bit on Sunday and say that's merely an option that Labour hasn't taken off the table yet. I think one of the underestimated things with this repeal bill, withdrawal bill, is that, you know, even if Theresa May loses four or five of her MPs, that doesn't matter that much if she can get that number of Labour MPs back on the other side. So if you can kind of, you know, if Anna Soubry does one thing but Kate Hoey does another, then actually they all cancels each other out. And so I think one of the things you're going to see over the next few months is the Tories trying to pick off, you know, individual Labour MPs. Now, that's not just going to be the Labour MPs who actually, that handful of Labour MPs who backed Brexit in the first place. I think it will also be people like Caroline Flint, who have a heavy leave vote in their own constituency, who think that looking like they're trying to thwart exit in any way will go down very badly. I also understand that Nick Brown has told people, and that might be an elaborate double bluff, that he is not planning on total mayhem. You know, for example, one thing that some of the more hardline Labour pro-European people wanted to do, and also the people who like parliamentary mischief, they were like, you can't, Isabel will correct me when I go wrong on the parliamentary procedure here, but they say that you can't guillotine the finance bill. So there was talk of just keeping the debate on the finance bill going and going and going and going and going, so the withdrawal bill couldn't make it to the floor. I'm told they're not doing that or any other kind of trick of that nature.
Thank you, Isabel. Thank you, James. And you can subscribe to this podcast on the iTunes store. It's called Coffee House Shots. And we have a special offer for podcast listeners of 12 issues for £12, along with a limited edition Moleskine notebook. Just go to spectator.co.uk/pod offer.